Good afternoon and welcome to the 8th GSV Virtual Summit series, the 8th in a series. Today I am very privileged to have an incredible group of panelists to discuss the future of digital learning AD, or after disease as we like to say it, and what the prospects are for the future. We have with us Anant Agarwal, the founder and CEO of edX. He's also a renowned professor at MIT, head of CSAIL there, many academic honors. And edX today has over 2,800 courses in partnership with over 150 global institutions, 30 million plus users, and has seen tremendous acceleration under COVID, but I'll let Anant talk about that. We have Matt Glotzbach, who is the CEO of Quizlet. He has been the CEO for the last 4 years when he took the reins from founder Andrew Sutherland, who actually founded Quizlet, for those who don't know, in high school before heading off himself to MIT. Before that, Matt spent 12 years at Google and YouTube, last running the Global Creator product, which, as we all know, has become a really important educational media platform globally since then. Quizlet today, 50 million students on a monthly active users, over a billion questions each week, 400 million virtual study guides, two-thirds of all high schoolers, one-half of college students, 130 countries, 19 languages. We have David Levin also with us today. David is the chairman of Spark Beyond, an AI-powered problem-solving platform whose mantra is unleash AI for impact, and we're going to come back to David on that point in that company. He's also an entrepreneur in residence at Arizona State University, our partner, and an advisor to President Michael Crow, which gives him a very interesting seat. Formerly, David was the CEO and president of McGraw-Hill Education for a number of years, and before that, the CEO of UBM, which is really one of the world's largest event corporations. Finally, last but not least, Kate Walker, who is the CEO, has been the CEO for the last year of Presence Learning since 2019. Presence has provided, for those who don't know, over 2 million online therapy sessions to K-12 students since its founding, 3,000 teletherapy sessions a day. It's the largest scaled provider of special education teletherapy to K-12 schools. Before that, Kate really grew up professionally in the edtech sector as Kaplan's VP of Strategy and Investments, the SVP of Tutor.com, and CEO of the Princeton Review. She also has an upcoming book that if we have time, I'm going to give her a chance to plug, but it will come out in the spring, The Good Boss, 9 Ways You Can Be a Better Manager. All right, well, let me start with this first question. I want to talk first about the topic of COVID. And can I ask really each of you to speak to the impact that the COVID isolation has had on your businesses, and in David's case, speak about it through the lens of ASU or perhaps some of your other endeavors. So Kate, let me start with you.
Sure, hi everybody. So for us at Presence Learning, COVID caused a dramatic shift in our relevance. I mean, as you said, Deborah, we were really viewed as the pioneers in the teletherapy market for K-12 schools. And we were a solution for those who had acute shortages of therapists on site in their district. So it was rural districts, it was under-resourced urban districts, it was not the majority of districts. And we'd reach out to a lot of districts and hear, we don't need teletherapy, or we prefer to hire on the ground. And then now all of a sudden, everyone needs teletherapy. And because we were out there ahead of everyone figuring this out for 10 years, how to do special education programs online, we now have this incredible responsibility to help everyone else figure it out. So it has led us to adapt our business model very quickly to try to address, you know, a much, much bigger inflow in demand for us seeking help from therapists looking to work in a new way, from schools looking to serve in a new way. So it's just a massive inflection point for us.
Well, you also, when we spoke, you also mentioned the fact that you guys have literally launched 2 new products in the last, you know, 8 weeks or so, in response to the COVID
We have, we launched a private practice platform to allow therapists across the country to be able to continue doing their work when they couldn't do it on site anymore. We saw such an influx of applications to come work for us, and we're like, we can't hire everybody. So we put out that private practice platform to give people a new way to do their work on the therapy side. And then we also launched new training programs for school teams in Teletherapy 101 and Teleassessment 101, where we teach them everything that we learned in these 10 years about how to do this well, and then we give them access to our platform to have the right tools to do it themselves.
Great. Anant, you wanna comment on what edX has seen here in the last few months?
Sure, thank you, Deborah. By the way, Kate, huge kudos to you as a family with a couple of close family members are special needs. The work that you're doing is just so, so important. And so may the force be with you.
Thank you.
The whole world has completely changed before our eyes, from 3% of the people learning online and virtually everybody working in person. We've completely gone to a model where 100% of the world is now learning online and 100% of the work is working remotely as well. During this time, edX has seen just huge growth in all that we do. We are an online learning platform where we have about 30 million unique students from every single country in the world. Before COVID, we were having about 5 to 10 million new unique users come to edX every year. And then in the month of April, just in 4 weeks, we added another 5 million unique learners. So we grew in 1 month about what we would grow in 6 months to a whole year in the past. In particular, very topical for this panel, computer science AI courses have seen a 9x, not 9%, but 9x uptick in enrollments from people all over the world. And we conduct surveys of learners. Why are you coming to edX at this time? What's special? And of course, 38% of them are telling us, we have time on our hands, we want to learn something new. So these are the new kinds of learners. But 62% is the same old, same old. 25% of learners are coming because they want to upskill and do better in their current jobs. 11% are coming because they've been recently furloughed or unemployed and they want to have better opportunities to learn with programs like MicroMasters in AI from Columbia or a professional certificate in soft skills from RIT and programs like that. And then another 11% of students are students in schools and colleges that are using edX to augment what they are doing. So in reaction to this, as you look at workers and schools, edX has reacted very rapidly in the past 8 weeks to create new products and programs for the world. One example is for universities, we launched edX Online Campus for free. This is a product where any university anywhere in the world can sign up and to our catalog of courses and get free courses for their students or their staff members completely for free. They can enroll during this COVID period, and then they can complete the courses through the end of the year. They're completely for free for any university in the world. We also launched a workforce program for anybody that's been sidelined or furloughed or laid off. They can come to edX and take any of our certificate programs with a 30% discount. And all they have to tell us is that they've been furloughed or laid off, and they get this big discount so that they can be upskilling fruitfully during this period.
Perfect. Thank you. Extraordinary numbers. David, do you want to take this and give your perspective?
Great. Thanks, Deborah, and thanks very much. And delighted to join you and all the other panelists as well. I think the ASU is in a remarkable place because obviously the online university was built almost with the capability of serving this need at this time. And, in 15 years of development has sort of been working on how you do that right and do that at scale. And the teams there have been flat out trying to do exactly that and making sure that it can deal with the surge in demand and pressure. I think on the on-campus side, the experience is, rather like every other school, trying to work out in a world of uncertainty how you deal with full immersion. I know the plan is to resume in the fall as a full immersion experience. And I think we're all going to have to wait and look and see what that actually means and what the changes will be. But I think in the round, the university sort of was incredibly fortunate, not by accident, by the way, to be right. placed in that way. Yeah. So that's kind of where it is, and we'll see. I've got to say, thinking more widely across the sector, I don't think many universities are in as have that solid base of an online university. And I think across the higher ed world, there's this frisson of fear about what does back to school mean. And I think everybody is right to be very anxious and thoughtful about how do we preserve this really important asset for our students, for our country, of this incredible resource of higher education. And it is facing a massive challenge. We'll no doubt talk about that.
Yes, it is. And we will. Matt, do you want to come in here?
Sure. Thank you. Thanks, Deborah. Great to be here. For Quizlet, it's an interesting story, and there's sort of two stories in one. The positive side is on a global basis, we're seeing massive uptick in growth. In our top 50 countries outside of the U.S., we've seen anywhere from 200 to 400% growth in new users signing up and joining the platform in the last couple months. And as you dig into that, what we see to try and kind of understand that story more is that's especially true in countries and geographies where there's a strong coordinated system of education, where there's really strong, oftentimes top-down guidance on how to make the shift to remote learning and really providing support to educators and students and families on making that transition. Now, the unfortunate other side of the coin, so to speak, is in places where there's less guidance and less support, we see a very uneven mix. And the US is one of those markets where, as you look across the US where our education system is highly distributed and local, we see, great examples like in Florida, and I know Deborah, you talked with Alberta Carvalho, superintendent of Miami-Dade. And, Florida is a great example, and Miami-Dade in particular, where they were prepared, right? They started planning, he talked about in January, and we see that in our data. They made the move and are back. They not only returned to pre-COVID levels, but actually exceeded them. And then you see other geographies, other states, other local districts where that move wasn't as coordinated. And so you can see there's a real gap there. And so I think one of the broader takeaways or questions really is, in those more distributed, localized systems, how are we going to ensure equity? How are we going to ensure that the learning continues? And David, as you said, especially as we look to the fall, and there's still a great deal of uncertainty of what the fall term is going to bring. So it's definitely interesting times.
Well, and that actually is a perfect lead-in actually to another one of my questions, which is, it seems to me, while, on the one hand, the digital learning sector, as we like to say, it's the dawn of the age of digital learning, and I'll kind of come back to milestones that you and Kate have both just had over the last week, which would indicate that the sector is seeing tremendous success financially. But on the other hand, to your point, it seems to me there is a real big burden on the education technology sector and educational institutions, period, at this moment to make sure that there are the issues of inequity. We can talk about that. Then David obviously referenced the issues of who is going to have the capacity to come back online physically and digitally. But there's also the question of how do we make sure that these learning experiences are engaging, that there is high retention, that it's easy for not only the student, but for the teacher, the faculty member, et cetera, and that we actually have learning efficacy. And as you read, as you follow anecdotal stories in the newspapers or on television, wherever you follow them, what you could only conclude that the results are very mixed. And I agree, last week with Alberto and talking about Miami-Dade, it was, turned on a dime, and it was seamless in their implementation of digital learning. So I'd love for you all to, you know, we have this theme, Hollywood meets Harvard, which is, we've always hoped that the education sector can catch up to the ability of our media, movie media sector to create engaging and high retention content. So I'm just curious if you all have thoughts about what the future, you know, needs to look like to make sure that we don't lose the gains that we've picked up, before COVID and then obviously accelerated with COVID. I don't know, Matt, you could actually pick it back up and start if you want.
Sure. You know, and I think it's a great point. And, you know, at the same time, I think it's really about a focus on the basics. You know, it sort of reminds me of that, the book, All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. I think tech companies should really, you know, kind of focus on and make sure that their first principles are sound. So number one, you know, build a product or solution that serves a real user's real needs. You know, not a fun, nice to have game or a fun convenience, but really focusing on the core needs. I mean, you know, the work that you're doing, Kate, I think is such a perfect exemplar of that. Number two, you know, you talked about Hollywood and consumer tech is a similar example. The time is constantly changing, right? And so we need to always be adapting with that change and evolving. You know, we can't just say, okay, we've got our product, we've launched it into the market, and then we're done, declare victory and move on. We've got to be rapidly responding and evolving, you know, with those needs of our users. And then the last thing I'd say, and anxious to hear from the other panelists as well, I think you touched on the key word there, Deborah, which is engagement. And I think too often in tech and especially learning technology, people mistake engagement and fun as synonyms. Don't get me wrong, I'm all for fun and things should be fun, but you know, learning is hard. Learning is hard work. And so we really have to create products and technologies that drive true engagement that deliver on that learning. And yeah, hopefully it can be fun along the way, but not confusing engagement and true depth of engagement, which leads to learning with fun.
Okay. Yeah. David, do you want to jump in and just really talk?
Yeah, Matt's absolutely right. And I think it's ironic, the promise that, you know, Bloom's Two Sigma problem way back in 1984, but, you know, defined this question of how do we move people from the curve into actual understanding and mastery? And then beyond that, how do we give them that individual guidance, which has always been the promise. And I mean, frankly, it hasn't yet really been delivered. There are bits of it emerging. And there are some quite distinct areas. Matt's absolutely right. The focus on entertainment as opposed to engagement is a terrible mistake and a risk. And I don't think there should be trade-offs. There's definitely a set of equations that you want stuff to be entertaining, but engaging and demanding and allowing people to get to mastery. The two big questions that we've always got to answer in education are, you know, I know something and you know I know something. Those are the two simple questions that we've just got to get through. And I don't think at this point we've really satisfied either, because that you get an A doesn't necessarily mean you know something. And that you have a certificate is at least the beginning of a qualification. Now, there's some interesting stuff happening around blockchain certification, which maybe is going to go somewhere. There are some interesting things around, you know, the use of adaptive tools and data. But at this point, you know, and as somebody who spent a great deal of money helping to build a lot of those adaptive systems, the actual level of use of the full capacity of those devices, of those systems, is still surprisingly low. And I think there's a resistance to the use of data in education. There are some legitimate questions about privacy and how you work your way through it. But we don't have the standards, and that's really crucial. So every company has its own set of data variables. Every institution manages their data differently. We're therefore not producing the quality of efficacy research that we should be doing, given the number of people involved in the system. And finally, nothing is interoperable. So everything is an island. We don't have data lakes. We've got data puddles, a lot of them.
Nat, do you want to have a jump in here on this?
Sure. You know, I like to joke, you know, as all of the universities went rapidly to online teaching, I have one word for how we all jumped into online teaching at this time. I call it RATS, R-A-T-S. It stands for Remote Accelerated Teaching for Students. And you know, there's enough people that believe that this is you know, teaching using Zoom, but is there learning happening? You know, are we doing some real learning? So I think the way we've all jumped into online teaching at this time at universities is really antediluvian. I think there's so much more that we can do through online learning as opposed to just plain old online teaching. You know, the number of techniques that we all know about and universities know about, take one simple one, active learning. This is a cognitive science inspired technique where, you know, discovered in 1972 in a very famous paper by Crick and Lockhart. So this is an old technique where rather than just conveying knowledge as in a Zoom class, what you do is you interleave short transfers of knowledge with interactive exercises. So short videos, say 5 or 7 videos with interleaved discussions and interactions where students test their knowledge and check things out. This form of active learning is the basic pedagogy of the edX platform. And we can make this foundational to a platform so that professors and instructors and teachers have to are forced to use that pedagogy or other pedagogies like peer learning, open feedback, or self-paced learning as part of learning platforms. And studies have shown, whether it's for workforce training, there's a very famous study for workforce training that showed that active learning on the edX platform, for example, improved learning outcomes by 25% versus showing people, you know, videos alone. So we have all of these techniques, and as universities and corporations, we need to move to these new techniques. And these learning platforms today have these techniques, just that they need to be adopted at universities. And to your question about AI, so much more that we can do. We can use the data in these learning platforms, the digital learning platform, you know, as particle accelerators for learning. We can learn much more about learning using A/B testing, where on websites, you know, when you go to buy toothpaste from Amazon, they're constantly showing consumers, you know, A screens and B screens to improve their outcomes. Similarly, we do the same thing all the time in learning on the edX platform, for example. Researchers from universities are trying and learning new things. So as we apply whether it's personalized learning through AI or using hinting frameworks through machine learning, or just simply understanding how people learn better using the big data of learning from these platforms, I think will really take us to the next level. But right now, all we have is practice.
I remember RATS. Kate, you of all the group have an audience that is from an engagement perspective is probably the, you know, highest level of challenge. What, you know, what do you feel like you guys can do to further improve your output and make this, you know, and make your product more, you widen the aperture of your audience in the COVID period, and anyway, take it from there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I think, I mean, the first thing I would emphasize is back to Matt's point on you got to get the basics right. I think right now the biggest differentiator that we see across our schools and students and whether learning's happening is whether or not the child shows up. They have to show up. And what's changed fundamentally is that to make that happen right now, you need parent engagement. And a lot of the tools that we built, that a lot of us built, were you know, around engagement in a school setting. And it's really different when you start needing to communicate, you know, regularly, and you're relying on parents to make things happen in a lot of different environments. So you know, we've been thinking about that a lot, that this shift is calling upon us to think about our product more from what would traditionally be a consumer lens. You know, I've seen it more in consumer products that I've built in the past where you're really thinking about including the parent in that dialogue around the education. And that's a big change that we're seeing is really important to get right now to make sure that the child shows up. We do see significantly higher absence rates for at-home service versus at-school service. And I know a lot of others see that as well.
Well, yeah, that's been a problem across the K-12 population, really, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's why Miami-Dade
has equity and access. Exactly.
Yeah,
so I think that's the big thing. That's the first thing. And then I think, you know, I guess I also highlight that one thing we know we know that one-to-one learning a student with an expert is incredibly effective. You know, we saw this back when I was at tutor.com. We certainly see it now in our therapy at Presence Learning. And, you know, we know that technology works really effectively in making one-to-one connections more affordable, more accessible, and so on. So we're finding right now that, you know, in the midst of so many shifting or just differences in a student's day-to-day, when you can maintain continuity and one-to-one connections, even if it's for small increments of time, I think that goes a long way, and it keeps progress moving forward, especially for our population. It's so significant, you know, when they've established a relationship and rapport with their therapist to make that continuous and get them that continued one-to-one focus. And for many students, it's 20 minutes twice a week. It's not, you know, the majority of their school day, but it's enough to keep them on track and to keep them going.
David, actually, I realized you one thing about this whole topic of helping us go to the next level of digital learning was actually you're talking a little bit about the event that you all are hosting at Arizona State later this summer.
Yeah, it's kind of Deborah. Well, I mean, one of the challenges that everybody in the panel has been speaking to is that the degree to which faculty at traditional on-campus universities were prepared for this shift. And many of them had been, many of those institutions had spent a long time just announcing why they weren't going online as opposed to anything else. And suddenly, wham, they're facing the shift. And at first it was, just do it for the back end of a semester and it'll all be okay. And suddenly we're seeing that, of course, it's not going back to normal. There is a new normal. So we, a number of us at ASU put together a concept which is now being rolled out on the 13th, 14th of July, which is an open and free event for faculty across the country, indeed from around the world, on best practices on online learning. And we're getting exemplars from institutions around the world, thought leaders, real contributors. And the intention is to really help the individual faculty member pick up some tips and tools which will lead to a better experience for them and their students in the fall. And so it's a very wide-ranging, very ambitious goal. That's what it is. The event is called Remote, the Connected Faculty Summit, and will run at ASU on a virtual platform which can actually accommodate some tens of thousands if we're fortunate enough to get them. But it's wonderful, and thanks for the chance to talk about it. It's great.
And would it be useful for K-12 educators as well?
Yes, in fact, that's one of the themes is particularly, not so much the K to 10, but certainly for high school teachers, it will be very relevant. And that's a subject that we should pick up later in the conversation.
Terrific. Okay. Then I want to come back to something I referred to earlier and talk a little bit to Kate and Matt on this topic, sort of indicative of what's happening in the digital learning space. Both Presence and Quizlet in the last week or so announced very impressive financings. I'll let Matt speak specifically to it, but Quizlet became a valued at north of $1 billion. Matt did not want to be called a unicorn. He wanted to be called a camel so he can explain to everybody what a camel is. And Kate saw a really important financing with Bain's double bottom line fund coming in to provide fresh capital, which appears to be pretty perfectly timed for Presence. And then today we also had MasterClass announce he hasn't said he's a camel yet, a unicorn financing at $1 billion with led by Fidelity. So obviously that's a contrarian set of facts. There are not many venture sectors that are doing aggressive markup, portfolio markup. So why don't you both talk about your very different financings, why they're such critical milestones, you know, what a camel is and all that sort of thing. So Matt, you want to start?
Sure. So I'll address the camel in the room, so to speak. So you're all probably familiar with the metaphor of a unicorn, which I think Eileen Lee was credited with coining the term for a startup that was worth $1 billion or more, and she chose a unicorn because of its rarity. And I can't take credit for the idea on the camel. Actually, credit to Alex Lazaro for that. He's a venture capitalist and writer, and sort of wrote about the idea. But I think over the last, you know, 5 or so years, the idea of a unicorn has taken on more than just that label. It's really taken on a mindset of kind of a growth at all costs mindset in Silicon Valley and around the world. You know, kind of a, hey, worry about growing users and we'll figure out the economics later. And so I think the camel mascot that Alex suggests is actually a better one because, well, first of all, camels are actually real creatures. They're real animals as opposed to mythical creatures like unicorns. But they survive the harshest environments in the world. They can go long distances without, you know, without much food or water. But one thing I didn't know, when they do find water, they're the kind of the fastest drinkers of any animal on the planet. They can guzzle 100 liters in 10 minutes or less. And they're actually really, they can sprint long distances if need be. And so when you think about building a business, one that you build responsibly, that can withstand the challenges of the tough times and kind of weather the tough times, but then when you see opportunity, capitalize on it, a camel is a really good metaphor. And that's really what we've been trying to do at Quizlet, you know, really since Andrew founded the company, you know, way back when, and then since I joined on, as you said, Deborah, a little over 4 years ago, you know, again, back to basics, right? Focusing on the core, having strong unit economics, and then growing, you know, growing aggressively, but growing smart, you know, smart, and what we talk about internally as is responsible growth. And so, you know, I think to your broader point about kind of the counter trend in the education space, I actually think the fundamentals are still critical. You know, business, and I would imagine you as an investor, you know, businesses that are chalking up massive user bases right now, if they still don't have a strong foundational business model behind them, you know, what does the fall, what does next spring bring for them as they're accruing all of these costs, but haven't figured out how to turn it into a successful business. So I think the, you know, we'll choose a camel over a unicorn.
Yep, no, I'm with you. I think one of the most exciting things is seeing all the fundamentally strong business models being created across education. And yes, I am an investor, and I'd be the idiot who didn't invest in Matt's last round. But anyway, I can publicly acknowledge that. All right, Kate, talk about your financing.
Yeah, so we raised $27 million in our Series D this week. It was led, as you said, by Bain Double Impact, and we had participation from our existing funds, from Catalyst and New Markets and Catamount. And, you know, I'd say getting a transaction done in this market was in some ways more challenging because suddenly forecasts for future years are out the window and everyone's reassessing. But it was also less challenging because I think no one questions now that there's a real place for ed tech in schools for us in the K-12 school market. And there was, you know, urgency on all sides, I would say, to get this done quickly in this environment, to get the resources in place and really make the most out of what's happening right now. And, you know, I do, you know, on your question about the sector, I think this is a testament to the investability of EdTech, but with patience. And, you know, I look at these funds like New Markets, like Catamount, who have been invested in us for a very long time, well beyond, you know, a typical 3 to 5 year time horizon. Yet they're stepping up and coming in for more because they understand that while time horizons can be longer in education, the opportunities are there and they're big. And so I think our funding is a testament to that as well, that, you know, there are real opportunities and big opportunities here, but it does call for, you know, a certain kind of patience and maybe a different kind of time horizon for our sector.
For the right entry moment, I mean, I would argue that looking at presence today, your entry moment may very well be right now.
Yeah, well, and I think that's interesting too, yeah. Right? When you look at our trajectory and lots of others, and you know how long is it going to take for these types of technology to be accepted, yep, in the end market?
Well, let me just push, Anant, you actually started down this path, but I'd love for just to get a little bit deeper on this. I know Matt's got a big initiative here. I know David is deeply invested in sort of the entire artificial intelligence landscape with his chairmanship. And Matt, I know you all have got a big strategy around AI, you know, driven tutors and not, of course, you're one of the world's experts on not just AI, data science, NLP, machine learning. I think this sector, I mean, we're really seeing very substantive companies built that are actually doing, you know, very, you know, not fluffy anymore, you know, very real things with emerging technologies. So, you know, maybe David, you start with your Spark Beyond business and the perspective you picked up there. And I know you focus on many sectors outside of education, but, you know, what do you see the potential to be? And then love to get, you know, other folks' comments as well.
Great. Well, thanks, Deborah. Well, Spark Beyond is a thinking machine. It's a hypothesis engine, which is very important in terms of the way it can amass massive amounts of compute to combine and contrast all sorts of different variables against a world that's very complex and come to that without cognitive bias. But broadly, the challenge that we see is that there's been too much promise and too much hype around the world, the words artificial and intelligence. And I think there's been a very great failure to work out what things are important and how to isolate them. Some parts of machine learning are fantastic at helping people drill and kill and learn something absolutely pat. Some bits are fantastic for extending knowledge and for being a repository for quick decision-making in complex situations better than a person. So I think the first is we've got to get the nomenclature right. The second is, I made the comment about data lakes and data puddles. Very few institutions have worked out a data policy which allows for research, true research at scale on the results that were coming through. And that's absolutely imperative that we actually drive to that. And it's a gating item. Very few of the commercial packages out there have the same data structures. And that means that we end up in a world of apples and oranges, and everybody talks about efficacy. It doesn't mean anything. So I think those are some very basic things that need to happen. And at the same time, it is incredibly exciting. And I think we need to be mindful that this ability to go to where the student is at that moment and help them at that moment. I know at ASU, tremendous success of the ALEX program, which really is finding students where they are with a given problem. So I'm very optimistic. I'm frustrated as well, but I'm very optimistic.
Good. All right, Matt, I'm going to have you make a quick comment because I want to make sure I get a lightning round question in before we have to turn it over to the next crew. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd echo. I think David's spot on, which is it's been overhyped and underdelivered. So, but I also don't count me a pessimist. I'm an optimist here. And I think the real opportunity is with AI generally, machine learning in particular, but I'd even go broader with technology. How do we take what we know about learning and take it out of the research lab and out of the cognitive science papers and into practice, right? And Anant, you talked about this, of like, we've known forever that interactive practice is a really good thing. We know that we know the right ways to study, to self-test and self-quiz, to spacing on repetition. We know that rereading notes and highlights don't work, right? So when we've known that for a long time, long before I was in the mix. But yet we haven't figured out how to like make that commercially available to students and educators in a way that's easy to apply. So I'm really optimistic about the opportunities for AI and ML in particular to personalize and adapt the learning. And kind of cut through a lot of the last decade of hype. But David, you're exactly right. It's going to take a tremendous amount of data. You mentioned Deborah at Quizlet. We ask and answer over 1 billion questions a week, and that's the scale of the data that you need to start to scratch the surface. Right. So.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We're down to like 1 minute left, so you're going to be very quick. But I'd love to get from each one of you sort of a big audacious prediction about the future of digital learning in the next decade. Not, we start with you.
Sure, I think post-COVID, this may not sound very audacious anymore, but I believe that the future of learning on campuses at universities is blended. There will be a much, much bigger meld of digital learning and in-person learning on campuses, both for business continuity reasons and also because blended learning is simply better. than purely in-person learning or purely online learning.
Great. David?
A wonderful comment, Anant. I'm in complete agreement. I think the breakdown between school and college and universities and K-12 is just such an obstacle. I'd hope that in 10 years' time, we're talking about grades 11 to 14 as a cohort and how we manage and help them prosper as a collective, and that would be a great outcome.
I agree with you. Matt, I do like
that. I don't know if this is about digital, but I think teachers and educators will rise to their rightful place of prominence as a highly respected, highly paid and coveted position. We'll revere them like we do doctors and tech entrepreneurs and business leaders, and we'll invest massively in their success and empower them to really drive education forward.
Great one. Kate?
So I'm going to predict that every school in the country is going to be providing online mental health therapists for their students. We're already talking about this as an answer to addressing the growing challenges of bullying and suicide and school violence. And now on top of that, every kid is going through a crisis and there's going to be trauma-induced behaviors to reckon with. So I think it's going to fall on schools to fix it. And I think online therapy is going to be the most efficient way to fix it.
Well, I'd love to see all four of those come to fruition. I think that's a perfect layout of ideas. Thank you all so much for being with us. It was a great conversation. And with that, I'm going to introduce our next speaker. I'm going to have Barry Merrick, the co-founder and CEO of Ivy, has a special opportunity for everyone on the line. With that, Barry.
Thank you so much, Deborah. Really appreciate you inviting me, and hello, everybody. So I want to just share, first of all, that Deborah and the GSV team have had such an invaluable impact on me and my journey, both as an entrepreneur and as an individual. So huge thank you for that. And in order to support the GSV community and also everybody on this call today, I want to share with you just a little bit about my journey and provide you with a gift that might be valuable to you personally, but even more importantly, to our colleagues and teams who are obviously doing all the really hard work so that you get to achieve your dreams. So I'm originally from Turkey. I grew up in Scotland, and then I had the incredible opportunity to study here in the US, both undergraduate and graduate school. And I love that experience so much that over the last few years, I've been convincing thousands and thousands of people across the country and across the world to help me create a lifelong university, which we call Ivy. And similar to Gerald Lonsdale, who's going to be in the next session, I'm a deep believer in the concept of tikkun olam, that we're all here to elevate the world, to leave it better than we found it. And based on my journey so far, I deeply believe that each of us has this truly limitless ability and opportunity to make a positive impact on our loved ones, on our businesses, but also our communities, countries, and the world at large. And I've found through my journey that there's two critical ingredients to unlocking potential. It really boils down to two things. And we all know this, but it took a while for it to crystallize in my head. So I'll share it with you what I think are the two key ingredients. One is learning. The other one is community. The mix of these two things help each person unlock their potential. So the more we learn about the world, the more we learn about ourselves, the better we're going to be able to navigate life. But no matter how much we learn, without the right people around us, without a community supporting us in our lows, but also in our highs, we're just not going to get as far. So my goal has always been to help unlock potential through learning and community. And I think we want these things for ourselves so we can live the best life we can, have the biggest impact we can, but also we want it for the people we care about. And especially in times like this and in the future, we're, I think, more aware than ever that how our team is doing, what they're capable of, what they're learning about, and what support they have is going to have the ultimate influence in our organizations and the people we care about. So with that in mind, we created a new initiative called Ivy for Business, and it's designed to provide learning and community to your teams in a unique way. And I'm excited to provide all of you here with complimentary access to everything that we do for the next month, but not just for you, although we'd love to have you. But even more importantly, this is something for your teams. So if you would like them to benefit from it, then we really encourage you to have them sign up. And to make this a bit more specific, What we do for your team, if you do have them to participate, and again, there is no cost to do this over the next month, we will introduce your colleagues to the leading minds in the world to connect with them live and to learn from them how to become better leaders, how to navigate critical world trends, and how to bolster their personal well-being. And to show you very specifically what I mean, so it's a little bit more tangible, if you can see my screen here, very specifically, the sessions we've got coming up, we've got tomorrow, How to Lead an Ethical Revolution with Airbnb's Chief Ethics Officer, Rob Chestnut. We've got Learned Hopefulness, How to Harness the Power of Positivity and the Science of Hope with Dr. Dan Tamasulo. We have something pretty much every day, but another one, two or three that I point out, How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci. This is next Friday. How to Become a Great Leader by Empowering Others, Francis Frey and Ann Morris, Harvard Business School. And finally, even from Bill Ackman, we're going to be learning about life and leadership lessons. So beyond the markets today, beyond all of that, how to deal with crisis and see opportunity in crisis and grasp it. So if you'd like to participate in all of these and get your team to participate too, we'd love to make it happen. I'll type my email here in the chat box, or you can also reach out to the GSV team. Finally, again, huge thank you to the GSV team and huge thank you to everyone here who is pushing education forward and helping people learn and grow better. Sincerely, from the depths of my heart, I thank you. And I wish that all you all keep up the good work and all the best. See you soon.
Thanks, Barry. I'm particularly interested to hear the Bill Ackman wisdom on life. But anyway, last week it was my real honor to interview one of the true legends of the venture capital industry, Dick Kramlich. Today, I'm really excited to have the opportunity to interview my friend Joe Lonsdale, the founder of 8VC. Joe is rapidly building a career which legends are made. He was the co-founder of Palantir, one of the original unicorns, now worth billions and billions of dollars. In fact, Palantir, if anybody's been to Palo Alto recently, Palantir owns like 25 buildings in Palo Alto. So I say that pretty soon Palo Alto is going to switch its name to Palantir to more reflect the true constitution of Palo Alto. Joe is the youngest person to be put on Forbes' prestigious Midas list, which goes to the top venture capitalist in the world, and is the founder of 8VC, which manages over $3 billion and is viewed as certainly, you know, one of the top venture capitalists, not only in Silicon Valley, but in the world. And I think in particular, Joe is as fine a person as an investor. And the initiatives that Joe and his team are involved with outside of just purely investing is inspiring, certainly to me, and I think inspiring to all. So welcome, Joe. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Michael. You lost weight during this crisis. You look good.
And it's been lean times out there. Thank you.
Yeah, can I tell a quick story about Dick while you have me? Because you just mentioned his name, and he is quite a legend. I was chatting with him. I actually have to mention this because he's such a great guy. So he had over 40% IRR during his career, right? Total legend in the industry. And I was catching up with him, and he had one of his funds from the 1980s. There was a company still running in that fund, and he went back recently and helped fix it. And 28 years later into the fund, they sent back a big distribution to their LPs. A lot of these LPs were passed away. It's their kids, it's institutions. But I thought that was the coolest thing, to go back to something from 28 years before, after already doing very well, and surprise everyone with hard work and a check. So I hope I can live up to that sort of track record in the next few decades.
Well, he's very, very special. But I think what you've already done in your career is remarkable. Talk about first, give me a little bit of the backstory on how Palantir began and then how you got into the venture capital business.
Sure. Well, I was really lucky to grow up around here in Silicon Valley and, you know, learn computer science from a young age. And when I was at Stanford, I worked with PayPal, and there were obviously a lot of interesting challenges there The Chinese and Russian mafia at the time were the biggest threats that killed off our competition. And at PayPal, we were able to figure out how to stop the bad guys and build a lot of new types of investigative technology. And while I was helping Peter build out his hedge fund, he was the first investor in Facebook and other companies. And I was a kid there. I get no personal credit for Facebook or for PayPal. I was just learning. But what we did do is we realized that the challenges that we'd face against the bad guys at PayPal could be kind of built more broadly to help the US and our allied countries against the bad guys after 9/11. And we saw the United States government, frankly, wasting billions of dollars very ineptly in our view. And we realized that technology in Silicon Valley had gotten to be far ahead of what they could do. So we got together our smartest friends from the Valley and we built this mission-driven company to both protect civil liberties with a privacy engine at the same time that allowing us to use the data the government was, you know, was putting together to help get the bad guys. And we obviously became the kind of infrastructure for the US and about 30, 40 other countries. And, you know, a lot of the people who built Palantir with me after a while, you know, a lot of them are still there. They're doing great, but a lot of them went on to build their own companies. And so I found myself advising and helping a huge number of new companies and ended up kind of becoming more of an investor that way.
So 8VC talks about solving some of society's biggest problems. And I mean, I think the world is broken, and one of the aspirations of 8VC is to fix the world. What does that mean? What are some examples of that? What's your investment approach, and what are you what's the lens that you're kind of processing opportunities through today?
Well, the reason we talk about it that way is that the framework is that we're not really doing our jobs in the venture capital and in the entrepreneurial ecosystem if we're not thinking about how the world could work better and how we could help push the world in the direction where it really should be. And so the role of our ecosystem is we're the evolutionary part of the economy. We're the part of the economy that dreams of the future and the dreams of what it could do better, what it should look like, given what's possible today that maybe wasn't possible in our parents' generation, maybe wasn't even possible 5 years ago. And so our job is to fix the world, to fix these problems, to solve these problems by creating more prosperity, by making these industries work better, by creating enabling growth, by enabling, you know, healthcare, education, all these industries to function better.
So Barry from Ivy gave sort of a spoiler alert that one of your philosophies is Tikkun Olam, and I probably butchered the name, but talk about that a little bit, how that influences your philosophy about both 8VC and your life.
Sure. Well, that's an important part of my Jewish background. I was raised Jewish by my mother. And, you know, a big part of what this acknowledges, which I think, you know, which is a really interesting philosophy, is the world's always going to be broken to some extent. We're people and we're flawed. And it's our job while we're part of this world to do our best to fix it and to help fix it and to help, you know, Tikkun Olam means to repair the world. And so there's lots of ways this could be taken. It's generally taken to mean social justice, which is obviously an important thing as well. To me, repairing the world means taking things that are broken and that could work better and should work better and pushing them in that direction where they're going to be able to help more people. And so everything we're doing, we're trying to think, how is this creating value for others? How is this helping the downtrodden? How is this helping those in need? And that's a really important thing to add in to anything you're doing on the entrepreneurial side these days.
So education obviously is an area that has a lot of fixing to do. And how do you see technology really fulfilling that vision that you have of fixing society, helping people? And how do you see technology enabling personalized learning?
Sure. Well, yeah, personalized is obviously a very big part of it. There's so much to do in education, as all of you guys know. I think the framework to me that's most interesting is, first of all, what are the new ideas and better ways of doing things, and how do we explore those? And then what are the mechanisms for competition? What are the mechanisms to make sure the best ideas win? The reason education is so hard, and the reason it's so hard for us to build these businesses in relative to a lot of other areas, is because there's not always as many direct mechanisms where the best ideas automatically win. If I do a much better idea in a certain area of finance with title insurance or with mortgages, it becomes very clear to those companies they're making more money with this, they're getting higher conversions. It's clearly the better way of doing things, and I very quickly win. If I do something better in personalized learning, and we have a lot of ideas there, as do you, the challenge right now is the mechanisms are not necessarily set up correctly. You might argue for decades about what's better, even if something's kind of obviously better to some people, you know there's a lot of special interests. It's very, very complicated. And so, you know, it's very clear this is a very big opportunity right now, just because we're all getting to do this stuff from home. And so it's an exciting disruption, as much as obviously it's not a good pandemic and it's bad for our country. It's an exciting disruption because it's forcing us to explore more ideas, to try more things, to get more people comfortable with what's going on. And it's very obvious the technology can help to personalize, can help to work with the teacher to make sure some of these mechanisms work better. I've seen 4 or 5 really interesting ideas people are pushing even right now. But the question all of us are going to have to answer is, what are the mechanisms to make sure the best ideas are winning? And I think that's actually the bigger entrepreneurial question on the education side, if you want to fix it.
Talk about, one of the areas where you have kind of constantly been pushing with smart enterprises and smart platforms. How do you look at that? And have you seen anything interesting in the education field where you would call it a smart enterprise, or at least a smart opportunity, smart enterprise opportunity platform? How do you think about that as it applies to education? Because obviously that's a thesis you applied in other sectors.
No, of course. I think that the analogies, of course, to healthcare on that are very interesting. How do you get a platform in place that's solving enough problems that it's going to be adopted by the schools and it's going to be able to be used as a workflow platform for things they're doing anyway? That then allows you to deliver content in a personalized way, allows the student themselves to get to explore and to get to see what the student's interested in. Obviously, learning, we all know, only really works well when the student's interested in it, when they're passionate about it, when they're driving it themselves as much as possible. And so there's a lot of these platforms people are trying to put in right now that are the kind of content delivery platforms. And, that's my bias on where this is going to come from. The people who own the content and are delivering it anyway should be the ones working with the teachers to give the teacher and student interactions that they record and to help let the student drive things forward, through there. And so we think we all know at this point, about what personalization should look like. We know what the main themes are. And the big question is how do you actually get in there to own the workflow? That's what Smart Enterprise is about, is owning valuable workflows that exist anyway, and then being able to use that data to build on top of it. And you see a few interesting people pushing for this in the education space. It's very unclear to me what the winning platform is going to be. I'd be very curious what you think about that, but it was still very early, but I my bet would be on the content delivery ones, if they can open it up and let the student express themselves through there.
Yeah, well, that'll be a fun conversation when we're able to visit your house again.
I look forward to it.
Talk about, you mentioned, I want to go back a little bit. You talked about Peter Thiel and worked with him, and you talked about Dick Kramlich and his career. Who's been your role models? You've obviously been involved with a number of incredibly successful technologists and venture capitalists. Who do you look at for kind of inspiration, and who are some of the people that you really look up to?
Well, these days it's interesting how our society works. We sort of reject heroes anymore, right? All of our heroes are flawed. So my approach is that all of my heroes have flaws as I do, but you still have amazing things you can learn from people. And whether we're talking about Elon Musk or Peter Thiel or Alex Karp, those are three people who are all just extraordinarily, impressive in certain areas and the best in the world in certain areas. And in my life, I've had to learn both from the things people are really good at as well as from their mistakes. Those three are amazing people. And other mentors here, Scott Cook has been an extraordinary person to watch. There's a lot of people like him who just have such high integrity and yet have also done really, really well and treated people around them really well. So for me, an important point is, how could you be the best in the world and how could you still take pleasure in the success of those around you? Really, for my father, I guess, would be my main role model, and that teaching me with my little brothers is the way to be really successful is to truly care about the success of those around you. And when people see that that's real and that's something that is who you are, you're going to go a lot farther in life.
Didn't your dad also teach you how to play like chess, two players?
Yeah, is the best chess coach in the nation. He's won the state almost every year, and he won the nationals the last 8 years. So he has a good background there too.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So you were a original investor in Oculus.
We were early in Oculus. Palmer Luckey is crushing it now. He's doing a new one too.
Yeah, well, maybe we can talk about that in a second, but talk about your view on virtual reality, augmented reality, and its role. Just overall, has it been slower than you thought? Where you think it's at today, but how do you see it playing its way into the education area?
Definitely. Well, venture capital is a funny business. That Oculus was one where Facebook, you could say, bailed us out. in the sense that they paid a lot of money for something that was a win to us. It's not clear it's been a win economically yet. It made a lot of sense why Facebook was doing it. For them, it was a risk aversion type thing. If augmented reality and virtual reality live up to their promise in the next decade, then the whole world's going to be running through some of these things, and the big companies are going to need access to those, you know, to those ecosystems. And so it made sense to me why Facebook did that as a kind of risk averse move, because Oculus had the very best talent, but we were very, very slow compared to what a lot of us expected. Augmented reality is taking a lot longer to really work. It does seem pretty obvious that augmented reality, virtual reality should be huge in education in the next 5 or 10 years. We're getting the price down to the point where we're almost there. We're getting some really, I mean, just imagine teaching history through these things. You're going to get kids a lot more into it. So I'm starting to see some early, really neat things. It's definitely still feels like to really realize it's another decade away.
Yeah, you talk about, you know, and back to, you know, sort of the philosophy of 8VC and Joe Lonsdale, you talk about fixing things for society, but you also, you know, 8VC's objective is to optimize returns. How do you answer to that contrast? I mean, do you see that as a contrast or a conflict, or what's your view on that?
I want to be careful here to respect that there's people of different political backgrounds who all view markets very differently. For me, I've tried building nonprofits, and some have done some pretty big things in my life, but the biggest successes I've had to have positive impact on the world is when I found a business model that worked. And what a business model means is people are willing to pay for it, and the resources you put in into what they're willing to pay, you're able to get a positive outcome where it naturally scales. There's been a lot of philanthropies I've built, and it's really hard, really expensive to scale them. If they're gonna need tens of millions of dollars a year, it's rare to get those going and get them off the ground. You know, similarly though, if you can build a business that funds itself, you know, with OpenGov, we started to build a business after the philanthropy couldn't scale. We now have 2,600 governments, you know, state agencies and cities using OpenGov, having hugely positive impacts. That would not have scaled to that point as a philanthropy. Maybe if I was Bloomberg, I could have paid for it, you know, as a philanthropy. But it's a lot easier to have a positive impact on the world with something that has positive returns. So that's generally my view, is they're very aligned. You do have to be careful. It's possible to make money in ways that are sketchy. But especially these days, the very top talent, they want to work on the missions that matter to the world. If you want to have something, a successful investment, it better be inspiring, because otherwise you're not getting the best people to help you.
Yeah. And amen. I couldn't agree more with that view. You've done a number of things in philanthropy outside of 8VC. One of those is Operation Mask. It focused on the current pandemic. Yeah. Tell everybody about that, because it's pretty remarkable what you're doing there. And I know people have approached me to connect to you because they know we're friends.
Awesome. Well, that was something that a few close friends in my network and my partners actually came up with that I supported starting of March, the beginning of March. It was very clear that we didn't have enough PPE, ventilators, masks, gowns, etc. And it turns out that there's logistics people we know all over the world. There's people tied to factories in Brazil and China and Vietnam and other places. And we realized the procurement officers at hospitals, their jobs were normally just kind of bureaucrats who just kind of went along with the process. They were not set up to go prospecting around the world and to set up deals to start producing these things. And frankly, now there was the government, the State Department, and the White House. This is not something they'd done before. And so it turns out that the people sitting in Silicon Valley and our friends sitting in China that have built a lot of companies that knew how to, you know, run global logistics, which is one of our specialty areas, we were able to right away spin things up and start making connections and getting things done. So, you know, at first we were helping about 30 or 40 health systems and hospitals with a group we hired and put together, and mostly with volunteers, of course. And then later on, FEMA kind of coordinated with us. We helped FEMA bring in several hundred million dollars worth of supplies. And it was kind of funny for us, because we'd think, who are we? We're kids in Silicon Valley. They're doing this. I guess I'm not a kid anymore, but we're young guys in Silicon Valley doing this. And it just there wasn't anyone in the nation tied to the right places that had the ability. So we just put it together.
I've got two questions left. First is, talk about Silicon Valley and, you know, the experience you've had working with other firms. I mean, some firms do an amazing job of really focusing on helping founders build their companies and work with other VCs and look at not as a competition, but really as a collaboration. Others don't. You mentioned, I know you're a fan of Andreessen Horowitz is an example of a firm you think that does things right. What do you see there, and what would your hope be as you see an ecosystem evolve to really accelerate innovation and entrepreneurship?
Sure. Well, you know, what's really great about Silicon Valley is the positive sum dynamics. I'm doing a reference call for Harvard right now with my, you know, in a couple of days with my friend who built Atomic, which builds lots of companies, and my firm builds lots of companies. And the first instinct of the person, you know, I talked to about this, and they said, that's really weird. Aren't you guys big competitors? You both build lots of companies in Silicon Valley. And actually, you know, you could think of it that way, but really we're not really, we cooperate a lot more than we compete because there's just lots of value being created. And the more we can help each other, the more we're going to both win. And that's the great thing about having a growing pie and a mindset of growth. It's very dangerous for our country if we ever get to a point where we're going to put rules in place where we're going to say, okay, we don't want growth, because that creates zero sum mindsets. And that's how you get everyone competing, everyone trying to take from each other. Silicon Valley with Andreessen Horowitz is a great example. You know, they act like good players in the ecosystem. They're doing their best to help entrepreneurs, to get back to them quickly, to show respect to them. What you sometimes find, the bad players, oftentimes hedge funds don't know how our ecosystem works, and they're very zero sum players. And so sometimes they'll come in and they'll be very sketchy, and they'll try to trick people, and they'll try to do things where last minute, when they realize they have strength, change lots of terms on people, and to the point where they're damaging companies. And so you see the good firms here are much more looking about their reputation and how to build together for the next decade, not how to kind of screw somebody on a near-term deal.
Yeah. Joe, you got the last question. You've got two young daughters. What do you hope?
We have a third coming in September too.
Oh my gosh. Well, I guess the
I'm surrounded.
shelter in place has been good for the family. Talk about what do you hope for them in terms of the education that they can have versus maybe what you had, or what do you think they need to thrive in the world that, you know, that we're entering?
Well, you know, if Athena's three and Aurelia is 1.5, and I already could tell they have very different personalities, very different interests. It's really important to me that whatever education system they're in, they're allowed to explore their interests. They should be the hero of their own journey, and they should get to say, here's what I'm interested in. And they should be supported in exploring what they're interested in and what their passions are. You know, we talked about chess earlier. Magnus Carlsen, the greatest chess player in the world right now. When I asked him, how do you study? He says, you know what I do? My teacher gives me, you know, 80 hours a week worth of stuff, and I choose the 40 hours that I'm most interested in, and I spend 80 hours on that, half of it. And that's a general rule to me for education and for anything you do in life. You have to focus on the parts you're interested in. You have to focus on the parts you're passionate about. So I'm really hopeful that my kids will have a system that lets them do that.
Joe, phenomenal. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed our conversation here and how much I look forward to actually being able to see you in person. So
I look forward to it too. I hope to see you soon.
Thanks to the GSV community.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, guys, you're awesome. And GSV community, thank you so much for tuning in, Zooming in. And we look forward to a great conversation in the future with our ongoing virtual summit series. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Take care.